Let's turn to 1 Peter chapter 3. We're talking about suffering in this context, suffering in the believer, in 1 Peter 3:13 through 5:14. We noted last hour, and I'll mention again by way of outline, that three types of suffering are covered in this section. It's the major section of 1 Peter. It deals with the major subject of 1 Peter, and that is hope in suffering. There's the suffering for righteousness that we're looking at right now, and we'll probably finish this hour in 3:13 through 4:6. Believers will suffer for righteousness. There is suffering with Christ, and that'll be chapter 4. We could call that suffering because of association, or suffering for our association with Christ. And then suffering in service, and that'll be chapter 5. So those three types of suffering will be dealt with in the last part of the book of 1 Peter. Now, we left off last week, or last hour, talking about our example of undeserved suffering in verse 18 through 22. So let's read those. Starting at verse 18, it says, "For Christ also died for sins once for all, the just for the unjust, so that he might bring us to God, having been put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the Spirit, in which also he went and made proclamation to the spirits now in prison, who once were disobedient, when the patience of God kept waiting in the days of Noah during the construction of the ark, in which a few, that is, eight persons, were brought safely through the water. Corresponding to that, baptism now saves you, not the removal of dirt from the flesh, but an appeal to God for a good conscience, through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who is at the right hand of God, having gone into heaven after angels and authorities and powers had been subjected to him." And we left off here verse 20. We finished verse 20. We were talking about how the angels, the fallen angels, the sinful angels in Genesis chapter 6, they call sons of God back there, had intermarried with human women, and that was one of Satan's attacks on the human race. He tried to pollute the human race by making a hybrid mixture of angel-human, so that Genesis 3:15, the judgment of Satan, could not be carried out. Because Genesis 3:15 said that there would be a man from the seed of Eve who would crush Satan's head. So it had to be a man. It had to be someone from the human race. So Satan set out to pollute the human race and make it into a hybrid race. After the cross, Jesus went to these spirits, and they were imprisoned in Tartarus, and he went to them and announced to them, it's all over. The cross was successful. It accomplished its purpose. You guys, your fate is sealed forever. And as Peter was talking about the blood, it brought to mind an analogy, an illustration of that. And that's where we pick up now with verse 21, where it says, "Corresponding to that, baptism now saves you." So this is going to be an illustration. And what it's going to be an illustration of is the last part of verse 20, when it talks about the flood. It says, "In which a few, that is eight persons, were brought safely through the water." And that's the part he's going to concentrate on when he says, "corresponding to that." Last week, we looked at some Greek grammar. And I saw a lot of blank stares, and I saw some yawns and some head bobbing. And what that grammar did for us last week was it kind of focused in on a verse. It let us enjoy that verse a little more because we could get a little more nuance of the meaning. Well, this week we're going to look at some Greek, and without it, I don't think you can understand these verses. Because when you read them in the English text, well, look at it, verse 21. Corresponding to that, baptism now saves you. Is he teaching baptismal regeneration here? Is he saying that you have to be baptized in order to be saved? Well, no, he's not. And let's look at some of the facts here. First thing, in verse 20, where it talks about eight persons being brought safely through the water, that phrase, brought safely through, is a single word in Greek, and it's the word diasozo. Sozo means to save, and dia means through, so it's a very simple compound word. What it means is to rescue or deliver in a physical sense. This is talking about these people who were saved physically. Acts 23 is an example. Acts 23, verse 24. Remember when Paul had to get out of town and he was under the protection of the Romans and they had to move him down to Caesarea? In verse 23 it says, and he called him two of the centurions and said, get 200 soldiers ready by the third hour of the night to proceed to Caesarea with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen. They were also to provide mounts to put Paul on and bring him safely to Felix the governor. And that's the same word, diasozo, to bring him safely. And it's talking about a physical deliverance there. Now back at 1 Peter, we note that the flood did two things. And the flood did two things that were absolutely opposite to each other. The first thing they did was they brought death and judgment to many. Remember, that's what the flood was for. There were these polluted hybrids, I guess I should call them, people running around on the earth, and God said, your days are going to be 120 years, and after 120 years, he sent the flood. And that took care of Satan's attack on humanity because it destroyed this hybrid race of human divine being. Divine, that's a bad word. Angelic, demonic. Although it had that effect, it brought death and judgment to many, it also carried aid through judgment to delivery. Now that's going to be what he's going to give an illustration of now. Death and judgment to many, but the eight carried through judgment to delivery. Baptism is an illustration of that, of those eight being carried through the floodwaters. The word corresponding to, and that's kind of misleading, I should say, corresponding to that, baptism now saves you. Baptism is an illustration because the words corresponding to is the Greek word antitupos. Antitupos. Well, antitupos is an antitype. We use that in English. We bring it straight over. An antitype. What is it? Well, an antitupos is an illustration, or it's the illustrating counterpart of reality. It's not the reality part, it's the illustration part. Look at Hebrews 9:24, and we get a very clear use of this word, maybe make it a little clearer. I think corresponding to is maybe an unfortunate translation. An illustration of might be better. Hebrews 9:24 talks about the holy place. And remember, the holy place was a place in the temple, first in the tabernacle and then in the temple. And verse 24 says, for Christ did not enter a holy place made with hands, a mere copy of the true one. And that mere copy is the same word, antitupos. So that holy place in the temple, the holy place in the tabernacle, was just a copy, an illustration of the real one in heaven. Well, that's the same word that we have. Look at Hebrews 10. Just go over a bit. In Hebrews 10:4, it tells what he means by this. Remember the bulls and goats that they sacrificed? Did that have any value in salvation? Well, verse 4 says, "For it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins." Why is that? They were just an illustration. They were an illustration of Christ. Back at 1 Peter, he says the same thing about baptism. It's an illustration corresponding to an illustration of that baptism. So baptism is the antitype of the flood. Verse 21, it says, corresponding to that. And the that points back to the waters, the flood waters. And I can say that for sure. It can't point back to the ark. Some say, well, it's talking about the ark. No, it isn't. Because the ark is feminine. And that is a neuter relative pronoun. The word water is neuter. Now, what does that all mean? Well, it means this. A relative pronoun in Greek must agree with its antecedent, and the antecedent is the word that it's talking about. That. What do you mean, that? Well, it's talking about something he said before in the context, right? It's either the ark or the water. Well, in Greek, that relative pronoun has to agree with its antecedent in gender and number. Not case, but gender and number. Well, the gender is different from ark. Ark is feminine. If he wanted to say that and mean the ark, he would have used a feminine relative pronoun. And you can't tell the difference in English. That, it would have been that also. But in Greek, you can tell the difference because they have grammatical gender. So it has to be referring to the floodwaters. So baptism is an illustration of the floodwaters. Now that means Peter is drawing an analogy here. He's making an analogy between the floodwaters and the baptism waters. The question is now, does baptism save us in a literal sense? Is it effective for salvation, or is it an illustration? Well, he just said it's an illustration. But he anticipates people are going to misunderstand. Peter's writing this. He says, an illustration of that, baptism, now saves you. People are going to misunderstand that. They're going to think that I'm teaching baptismal regeneration. So he makes sure that you don't misunderstand, and he does that by using two words, the word not and the word but. Look at verse 21. And I'm going to say, as an illustration of that, that is the flood, baptism now saves you, not the removal of dirt from the flesh. That's not the part that saves anybody, but an appeal to God for a good conscience through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So it isn't the outward washing of baptism that produces salvation. It's not removing dirt from the flesh. That can't save anybody. And that's what he's saying. Baptism cannot cleanse anyone from sin. It can only cleanse you from dirt. So this is an illustration. Now, some take this to be a reference then to spiritual baptism. They say, well, it's spiritual baptism that he's talking about because water baptism can't save you. And that's kind of cheating, really, because that's not what the context would indicate. Because when the New Testament talks about spirit baptism, it never talks about it in terms of what it can't do. It always talks about it in terms of what it does. This isn't talking about spirit baptism. It is talking about water baptism. But it's talking about it as an illustration of what happened at the flood. Peter goes on now in correcting a possible misunderstanding by saying, no, it's not the removal of dirt from the flesh. It's not the water part a baptism that saves, but an appeal to God for a good conscience. So he gives baptism another name, an appeal to God for a good conscience. And that, we could say, an appeal to God from a good conscience. Do you have that in your margin? I have that in my margin. It says, corresponding to that, baptism now saves you, not the removal of dirt from the flesh, but an appeal to God for a good conscience. And that for has a one by it. And over in the margin, it says, or from. And from is a much better translation in this context. It's an appeal to God from a good conscience. Now, the word appeal, eperotema means a pledge. It's a pledge to God from a good conscience. What does that mean? Well, it means that baptism is a visible symbol that we have a good conscience before God. It's a visible symbol that we have a right standing with God. That's what baptism is all about. When people get baptized, why do they do it? Well, I want to proclaim the fact that I'm saved. And that's what baptism is. It's a proclamation of the fact that you're saved. And that's what Peter's saying here. He says it's not the water that saves you. It's a pledge that you have a right standing with God, that you believe the gospel message. That's what baptism is. Now, question, how can you have a good conscience before God? I'm a sinner. I know that. How can I have a good conscience before God? So how can baptism be a pledge of a good conscience before God? Well, because I know that Jesus Christ died on the cross to pay the penalty for my sins. How do I know that worked? Remember, what was the proof of the fact that Christ's death did what it was intended to do? The resurrection was the proof, right? That's what Peter says. It's a pledge to God from a good conscience through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. That's how I get that good conscience, because Jesus Christ was raised. So I know that my sins are paid for. I have a right standing with God. And that's what baptism is all about. It's a pledge to say, I have a right standing with God, not based on what I've done, but based on the work of the cross. Now, verse 22 gives us the result of his suffering then. Verse 22 says, and remember, this is our example, and these people down in that 1 Peter was writing to were being persecuted. They were suffering up to the point of death, and he's giving them Jesus Christ as an example, and he says in verse 22, who is at the right hand of God, having gone into heaven, after angels and authorities and powers had been subjected to him. And that's what he went to Tartarus to tell these guys. You're subjected to me. I won, in other words. The cross worked. So glory is always preceded by suffering. Now here we have Christ glorified after he died on the cross. Glory is always preceded by suffering. So if you're suffering as a believer, stop and think about what Jesus suffered. He suffered, and he's glorified now. If you're suffering, or even if you're not, if you're a believer, you will be glorified. So in other words, take the long view. Look at it from the standpoint of eternity. Yes, you may suffer now. You may suffer even to the point of death. These guys were. And yet, Jesus Christ, our example, suffered to the point of death. And he's in glory now. And we'll be there with him. So that's why Peter put in this little section. It's encouragement. Remember, we called this, the whole book of 1 Peter, hope in suffering. Wow, what more hope could you have? Jesus Christ suffered. He's in glory. If you suffer, you'll be in glory. If you're a believer, there is hope in suffering. Now that brings us to chapter 4. Chapter 4, verse 1 through 6, talks about getting rid then of the old life. Let's read that. Starting in chapter 4, verse 1. It says, "Therefore, since Christ has suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same purpose, because he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, so as to live the rest of the time in the flesh no longer for the lusts of men, but for the will of God. For the time already past is sufficient for you to have carried out the desire of the Gentiles, having pursued a course of sensuality, lusts, drunkenness, carousing, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. In all this, they are surprised that you do not run with them into the same excesses of dissipation, and they malign you. But they will give account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. For the gospel has for this purpose been preached even to those who are dead, that though they are judged in the flesh as men, they may live in the spirit according to the will of God." Here's an outline of this short little section. We're going to make 3 points in this section. First will be a command for a right mental attitude. That's verse 1. It says, arm yourselves also with the same purpose. That'll be the command. Why? What's the purpose of that command? Well, that's verse 2. So as to live the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for the lusts of men, but for the will of God. That's why we should arm ourselves with the mental attitude that Christ had. And 3 through 6 is going to be the reason. Verse 3 says, "For the time is already past." He's going to say, you guys have plenty of time to live it up. Now let's get down to business. So we'll start with the command, 4:1. And the pattern is going to be for our mental attitude. The word "therefore" in verse 1 points back to chapter 3, verse 18 and following, that we studied last hour. What did we study? Christ died. He suffered undeservedly all the way to the point of death. So he's going to be the pattern for our mental attitude. Now back in chapter 2, we had two aspects of Christ's suffering. Chapter 2, the first aspect of his suffering is the exemplary aspect, we could call it. Verse 21, it says, "For you have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. And while being reviled, he did not revile in return while suffering. He uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously." That's the exemplary aspect of Christ's suffering. There's another aspect, and that's the substitutionary aspect. Verse 24 says, "And he himself bore our sins in his body on the cross." Now, the question is, which of those are we to emulate? The exemplary aspect of his suffering or the substitutionary aspect? Well, obviously, we can't substitute for anybody. So I take it we're to emulate the exemplary aspect of his suffering. And notice in chapter 4, Peter phrases this in a way that would indicate that too. It says, chapter 4, verse 1, it says, "Since Christ has suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves also." He doesn't say Christ has suffered in the flesh for us. He just says Christ suffered in the flesh. Never mind what it was all about right now. Our attitude is to emulate his attitude when he suffered in the flesh. So what's that attitude to be? Well, it's his attitude that we're to emulate, and that attitude is selfless, undeserved suffering. You know, Jesus Christ, and I've mentioned this before, was the only person in the history of the entire universe who suffered without deserving it. it said back in chapter 2, he committed no sin. He did not deserve to suffer. He was the only one who did not deserve it. Everybody else committed sin. He did not retaliate. He did not threaten. And think of how he could have retaliated and how he could have threatened. He could destroy the universe with a thought. But he didn't. Didn't retaliate, didn't threaten. What did he do? He kept on depending on God the Father. And that's what we're to emulate in our suffering, even if we don't deserve it. And our suffering is deserved. I mean, even if it isn't directly deserved, we're all sinners. So if you've got a rotten boss, you know what? Maybe you don't deserve to suffer. Maybe he isn't fair. Maybe she isn't fair. But you know what? Christ suffered, and he suffered to the point of death, and he really didn't deserve it. So what did he do? He kept on depending on God. And that's what we're to do when we suffer. Keep depending on God. Now the word arm yourselves in chapter 4, verse 1, is a word meaning to get ready. And it's kind of a military term. It was especially used for the equipment that a soldier put on. Remember in Ephesians 6, the full armor of God? It's kind of that idea. But what is our full armor here? Peter's talking about something else. Our weapon is a right mental attitude, the one that Jesus exhibited when he was suffering. So Peter's making a little different point here. He's saying that we can arm ourselves with a good mental attitude. Now, the reason I say mental attitude, and we have in our translations, it says, arm yourselves also with the same purpose. That word purpose is a Greek word enoia. And some of you might recognize this. It's a very simple compound word. En means in. Noia means your mind. So literally, this word means in your mind. Thought would be a good translation. We use this word in English when we say paranoia. You may have heard that word. Now, the Greek preposition para means beside, or figurative. Literally, it's a preposition that means right beside. Figuratively, it means irregular. And they got that from, well, here's how it should be and here's how it is. They're not, you know, together. It's irregular. So paranoia literally means in Greek an irregular mind. So ennoia means in your mind. So it refers, I'll read Bauer, Danker, Arndt, and Gingrich's definition of it. It refers to the content of mental processing. The content of mental processing. Thought, knowledge, insight. Everything you think about. What would we say? We'd call that mental attitude, wouldn't we? Everything that goes on in your head, your mental attitude. And that's what he's talking about. We're to arm ourselves with the same mental attitude that Christ had when he suffered. Why? Well, look at the last part of verse 1. Arm yourselves also with the same mental attitude, because he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin. Peter's making an example, a parallel here, between Jesus and us. Because he's talking about the therefore goes back to the section of talking about Jesus' undeserved suffering. And now he says the reason that we should arm ourselves with his mental attitude is that he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin. So when Jesus suffered in the flesh to the point of death, he ceased from sin. What does that mean? Well, it means he suffered once in the past for sin, and as a result, he never has to deal with sin again. Why not? It's dealt with. It's done. That's what he went to proclaim to the guys in Tartarus. It's over. Your fate is sealed. Now, if we grasp that, if we think about that, if we adopt his mental attitude, then we will realize that if we suffer, and suffer to the point of death even, for him, what is that? we're home free, right? I mean, if you believe this, that's what he's saying. If you suffer to the point of death, you know what? You're home free. You've got it made. You'll never have to deal with sin again. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Wow, that's a good thing. Now, I'm going to throw in a disclaimer. Because people have said to me over the years, and I've heard this several times, you Christians, you're all alike, you know. You say how wonderful it's going to be in heaven. Why don't you just go out and kill yourself? Well, I got work to do. And if I have to suffer, so what? When I get there, it'll be worth it. And that's what he's saying here. I'll never have to deal with sin again if I suffer to the point of death. And that's what Jesus knew. He was successful. So the Christian, armed with this mental attitude, should live a Christian life that's pleasing to God. And that's verse 2. It says, so as to live the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for the lusts of men, but for the will of God. And that goes back to arm yourselves also with this same purpose. Why? So as to live the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for the lusts of men, but for the will of God. So even though, and Peter says it here, that the coming of Christ is near, down at verse 7, he says the end of all things is near. Even though that's true, there's still what he calls a rest of the time in the flesh. We still have time living here, living in these bodies, in the flesh. So we're to live out that time with a correct mental attitude. The same mental attitude that Jesus Christ displayed when he suffered. And that attitude will result in a change of lifestyle. Now notice, this is not automatic. It doesn't say when you become a believer, you automatically have a change of lifestyle. It doesn't say that. It says arm yourself with a correct mental attitude. If you do that, then you'll have a change of lifestyle. If you adopt the mental attitude that Christ had, then you will have a change in life. It's not automatic. Arm yourself is an imperative mood verb in the Greek language. And in the Greek, an imperative mood is an appeal to your will. So he's saying you have to put your will to it, to arm yourself with this mental attitude. The reason, verse 3 through 6, now notice in verse 3, he says for. He's expanding on his thought here. He's given another reason to adopt the mental attitude that Christ had. And the reason is really simple here. This is easy to understand in any language. He's saying, you guys have had plenty of time to live under human viewpoint. And that's what he says when he says, for the time already past is sufficient for you to have carried out the desire of the Gentiles. That you had plenty of time for that. Now it's time, now that you're believers, to adopt a correct mental attitude. When he says the desire of the Gentiles, what we would call that human viewpoint. You've had enough time living under human viewpoint. Now it's time to adopt divine viewpoint. Have you ever noticed that the world at large does not share our attitudes? And I'm being facetious because it's very obvious. The world doesn't share our attitudes, doesn't share our beliefs. We've had plenty of time to live under the world system. Now it's time to live under God's system. It's time to get a right mental attitude. Now, he gives some examples here. The end of verse 3 says, having pursued a course of sensuality, lusts, drunkenness, carousing, drinking parties, and abominable idolatries. Now in verse 4, he's going to say that, you know what, if you adopt divine viewpoint now, after having spent all that time, that plenty of time, in human viewpoint, somebody's going to notice. And that's going to result in something, and that something is suffering. Now, the unbeliever doesn't understand a lifestyle that's based on God's will or divine viewpoint. So it's noticeable if you change your attitude. Very noticeable. And you know what? People will see that and they don't understand it. What's the first reaction if you don't understand something? Boy, you know, that Kaler, he used to be a fun guy. And I was a fun guy, I'll tell you. According to human viewpoint. All of a sudden, he's no fun anymore. All he ever talks about is the Bible, you know. He talks about salvation. He's always telling us his gospel message. He's gone nuts. They don't understand that. And when you don't understand something, the first reaction is to fear it. People get afraid. And so they, what do? They try to write it off. Well, he's a loony. You know, Kaler went loony. Just that simple. So you're going to get hostility. So prepare to be maligned. And that's what verse 4 says. It says, in all this, they are surprised that you do not run with them into the same excesses of dissipation. What happened to you? Don't you want to go out drinking tonight? Well, no. I've got a Bible study, you know, and that. No, I don't do that anymore. So what happens? They malign you. They start writing you off as a nutcase. Actually, the word maligned here is the word blasphemed, slandered. They start making up things that aren't true about you to explain what they can't understand. Verse 5 says, take the long view. Verse 5 says, but they will give account to him who is ready to judge the living and the dead. So, is there somebody making fun of you because you're a believer? Is there somebody that's talking about you, saying bad things about you, calling you a nutcase because you're a believer? You know what? You're not the one who has the problem. They are. Why? Well, they're going to have to answer to God. If they don't become believers, they won't like the results of that. So keep that in mind if you're suffering. If people are talking bad about you, calling you crazy, you're not the one that has the problem. They are. So verse 6 kind of sums up what you might call the career of the believer. Verse 6 says, for the gospel has for this purpose been preached even to those who are dead, that though they are judged in the flesh as men, they may live in the spirit according to the will of God. Now the reference in verse 6 here is to believers who have died physically. And it doesn't mean that the gospel is preached to them after they died. It means the gospel was preached to them before they died. They're believers. And then verse 6, the word preached is the word euangelizo. It's the proclaim good news form of the word preached. So he says, while they were alive, they were judged in the flesh as men. And that's a reference to the persecution that they were suffered from unbelievers. Verse 4, those unbelievers, they're going to malign you. They're going to slander you. And verse 6 says, yes, they were judged in the flesh as men. Well, that's kind of a bad translation. And actually, King James has it better in this one. It says, judged according to men in the flesh. That's a good translation. What it means is, while these believers were alive, they were being judged by men's standards, by unbelievers. But now that they've died, they can live in the Spirit according to the will of God. You see what he's saying there? He's saying that, yes, these guys were judged according to men when they were alive, but now they may live in the Spirit according to the will of God. So what could you conclude from all of that? Is suffering to the point of death such a bad thing? And that's what Peter is trying to give these guys as a lesson. If you have to suffer, have hope in that suffering, because the end is glorification. If people talk bad about you, if they make fun of you, if they speak ill of you, they're the ones that have the problem, not you. They are. Father, thank you for your word, and thank you for the hope that you have given us. That even though we might suffer in the flesh, and I know all our sufferings are different, but we might suffer even to the point of death for adopting divine viewpoint and doing your will and trying to live a life pleasing to you. even if we suffer to that point of death, in the long run, we face glorification. And we can depend on that because you've told us in your word. Father, in Christ's name we pray. Amen.